from Munich Technical University, Jan studied mathematics at Bremen University, and after that a long journey from Edinburgh to Oxford and then back to Munich, and in between he was working with ballet as well, and on his long journey he received his PhD as well, so in for engineering of security software, specifically using CMS for developing secure software. And so this today will be on secure programming tests, which is not only important for Stuttgart, but I think for each one who is programming in C, because that is the most dangerous language, I think this will be interesting for everyone.
Hello. Thank you very much for the introduction. Yeah, so as you can see from the title, I was trying to make this a little bit more general, not just programming, but general software engineering. And on the other hand, I'm trying to also focus a bit on embedded systems, because I was told that this is particularly interesting here. There was already some introduction on myself, so I don't really have to say much about that, but maybe I should say that I'm not only doing research at the moment at TU Munich, but also we are having quite extensive collaboration with industry and various projects, and so this is also something I will mention during for the experiences during the talk. And this is actually part of a series of tutorials, most of which are more centered on UML and using UML, because this is what my PhD was about, but this I'm not going to do to talk much about today. I will just mention it briefly, but mainly concentrate on programming issues. So firstly, some motivation. This is probably well known to everyone now that security has become quite important, not only in the military domain, where it used to be important, of course, all along, but for the last couple of years, computer security has become quite important also for civilian applications, simply because the complete infrastructure of today's society and economies increasingly rely on computer networks. And these computer networks are often open networks, such as the internet, and thereby they are easily attackable. And this is where the problem starts. And also the problem is that the networks such as the internet were not actually designed to be used in the way that they're used today, with many users, not all of them are trustworthy, and also not designed to be used in situations such as e-commerce and so on. And that's why it's not really designed to offer the protection that you would really need to perform such security critical communication over the communication network. And so that's the starting point for the situation we have right now. And the second thing is, not only are many systems not designed to be secure, even those systems that are designed to be secure are not always as secure as they are supposed to be, because of mistakes in developing systems, programming mistakes, and so on. And this is also what I'm going to talk about a bit today. And the point is that it's really not so easy to develop systems correctly in a way that they are actually secure in the end. And the problem here is that you always have to worry about a motivated adversary who will try to attack your system and who may be quite sophisticated at doing that. So it's different from considering things like safety, where you only worry about random failures in hardware, for example, because usually hardware doesn't fail intentionally, but something like randomly, or at least in certain situations. But with security, you really have to worry about a motivated and knowledgeable attacker. And of course, there are many examples for that, where people really manage to break into systems, and you hear about that every day, more or less. And well, you can wonder why this is actually the case. I mean, the problem itself has been known at least among security researchers for 20 or 30 years, that it is so difficult to develop secure systems and that you make so many mistakes. And the point is simply that it is that it's difficult and that even experts can fail in the attempt at constructing secure systems correctly. And a classical and well-known example in the domain of security engineering is the security protocol, which was developed in 1978 by two of the early experts in the field, and where there were two kinds of attacks pointed out, one of them in 81 and the other one 70 years later in 95. And so this is just a motivating example to show that it's really difficult to design and implement secure systems correctly. And the point now is that it's not sufficient to just use security mechanisms such as cryptography and say, okay, I'm using SSL to encrypt my internet connections and therefore everything is okay. Because the problem usually is that attackers try to attack not the security mechanisms such as encryption or security protocols, but they try to attack the way that these mechanisms are used in the system context. And that's really usually where the weaknesses are. Between the boundaries or the layer, the different system layers, maybe between the hardware and software layer, or between different components of the system, or maybe in the way that the system is supposed to be used, and in the end it's going to be used in a different way, and that way it will also be insecure. And there's a motivating example here. I think you cannot really read this. Can you make this larger? Anyway, this is supposed to be a street in the picture where, okay, yes, thanks. Where there's a bar which attempts to block cars from going through the street, but as you can see in the example, the cars simply drove around the bar on the grass. And that's an example for a security mechanism which in itself is perfectly secure. No one even tried to break through the bar, but it's not used in a way in the context which would make the overall system secure. And that's really simple example, but this is really the situation that many computer-based systems work. And and another problem is that in practice you always have to worry about getting the system done as quickly as possible and as cheaply as possible. And so that's the main reason really is that it's always a conflict between various requirements such as security, where security is only one of the requirements, and between the cost and the time to market of the system. And that's maybe where the real problem is, because if people had enough time and had enough time to think about the system and to try to attack it themselves and maybe show it to their colleagues and ask them what they think, then eventually all these problems which we see today maybe wouldn't even be there. But the economical situation is so far that it has obviously paid to rush out systems as quickly as possible. I mean, you can see that with one of the more popular operating systems, and it's obviously a very high economic success, but you can also see that there are a lot of bugs in there, simply because this is the situation. Developers have to bring out the system as quickly and as cheaply as possible, and that's in the conflict with the quality of the system. And the problem is that with security, this is a particularly bad situation, because you cannot really test security. And if you consider other requirements such as performance, you can test your system, and if it's fast enough, then you will release it, and otherwise we have to deal with the problem. But with security, it's not easy to say that something is really secure. So this was the motivation for why you should actually worry about security to start with. And now I would like to start with introducing some security requirements and then go on to explaining some techniques for secure systems development. So firstly, security is really a relatively large area in itself. In a way, it's sort of orthogonal to every other aspect of the system. So in every layer of the system can be attacked by an adversary, and every aspect of its use can potentially be attacked. And that's why you have to worry about so many different requirements here. So firstly, just to put this into perspective, I just mentioned that what you would call in German Sicherheit, in English really has two different meanings, namely security and safety. I already mentioned that earlier. Security is protection against attacks, and safety, well, safety is protection against faults, for example, in the hardware. And also another distinction which is sometimes made is that in security, you want to protect the system itself, or maybe some security critical data, whereas in safety, it's often the case that you worry about the humans that use the system, or maybe that if it's a medical device, the patients that you know, that are not supposed to suffer if the system goes wrong or something. So these are different aspects, and here in this presentation, I will just concentrate on security and not on safety. But even in security, you have quite a lot of different goals which you want to reach with respect to different parts of the system or with respect to different pieces of data in the system. And so the more important ones are integrity, confidentiality, availability, accountability, and non-reputability. And I will explain them in more detail in the next two slides. But there are also other ones which I will not really talk much about here because they are really more specific to particular applications. And on another layer, in order to enforce these goals or to reach the goals with the system, you can use different kinds of conceptual functions. So, for example, you can try to identify people, or you can use some authentication mechanism. This I will also explain later what this means. Then you can try to perform authorization, meaning that certain people are authorized to do different things by using some kind of rights management, and also different other kinds of conceptual ideas, such as logging, audit data for security critical information. And then maybe on the bottom layer, you actually have the mechanisms within the system, how you can actually, which you can actually use to enforce these kind of different functions. And these can be different kinds of hardware mechanisms, such as smart cards, or you can use software mechanisms, such as passwords, or access control mechanisms, and so on, or maybe cryptography. So these are just, for the moment, a lot of different kinds of terminology, and some of this I will explain on the next couple of slides. But you know, the area on the whole is too large to explain every aspect of this in detail just within 2 hours. So I have to make a certain selection, and I will focus on the more important issues, and then also to say a bit about embedded system security. So firstly, maybe the three most important security requirements are secrecy, integrity, and availability. So secrecy is probably intuitively well known what this is supposed to be, that data is supposed to remain secret or confidential, meaning that unauthorized parties should not be able to get to know this kind of data, and maybe not even know parts of the information. This really depends on what this data is. For example, if it's your credit card number, then maybe you don't want anyone to even know half of the numbers, because they could guess the other half with some, in some way. So it, sometimes it's really, you worry about even a partial flow of information. Then the second kind of requirement, integrity, is sort of in the opposite direction. So while here you're worried about information getting out of a certain part of the system, here you worry about information being modified or being attacked from outside this system part, again by unauthorized parties having interaction with the system. So these security requirements are always formulated relative to some kind of adversary model, which can be someone who is external to the system, but can also an internal user of the system. And so you always have to keep in mind that this is as important as the security requirements themselves is the question who the adversary is that you have to worry about. So firstly, who it is, and secondly, also what kind of strength you can expect from someone like that. So for example, if you worry about someone trying to break a pay TV system who may have like a modest level of sophistication and of motivation, and this is of course different from having to worry about someone trying to attack a military system who will of course have more resources and a higher motivation. Then the third kind of requirement is availability, and this is the requirement that access to information should be always be guaranteed throughout the execution of the system. Then two other kinds of important security requirements are authenticity and non-replicability. And these are also in a way dual to each other, and both are about linking a creator of a certain piece of information to the information in one way or the other. And so a good example to think about these requirements are electronic contracts, where you sign some statement with a digital signature. And there you have two kinds of requirements. Firstly, it should not be possible for someone else to sign a contract and then later claim that you signed the contract yourself. And this is the requirement of authenticity. So it should not be possible for someone to masquerade as someone else. And then on the other hand, it should not be possible that someone signs a contract and later denies that he signed the contract. And this is sort of binding the information to the signer of the information in the other way. And both of these requirements you usually assume to have in the physical paper and pencil world, but it's generally not very easy to also implement them in the digital world. So this is generally also about the other kinds of security requirements. They always have some sort of analog in the physical world, where you deal with paper and handwriting and so on, and you can always try to implement it in the digital world also, but it's really non-trivial. And the reason for that is, for example, that in the digital world, where you always deal with bits, you can easily copy information. And this is, of course, what is on the sort of the foundation of computing, that you can send bits along the computer, and so on, and of course also an adversary can do this, and this is really different from copying a piece of paper, where later you would be able to see that someone used a copy machine and did not actually sign the contract on the copy or something like that. And this is the real problem which we have to worry about in computer security. So now with the general, after the general introduction, I would like to start with some more specific situations where possible attacks can arise. And firstly, I will talk a bit about the situation of the internet, because that's really in the focus of many security problems these days. To put it shortly, an internet connection which is not secured in any way is really very, very vulnerable. And you can simply assume that an adversary has complete control over the communication that goes along an internet connection. And why this is, we have to assume that, I will shortly explain on these slides. So firstly, it's rather easy to eavesdrop, to read the information that is exchanged over an internet connection, and where you do this on the technological level is using so-called packet sniffers. You think about an Ethernet network. These devices allow you to actually access the information which is broadcast on the Ethernet network and thereby read information which is not meant to be sent to the adversary. And this is really part of the underlying implementation of this network system. So it's easy to read information. Of course, provided you have some sort of physical access to the network, but with the internet, it is an open network, and therefore it is the access is there. Then, so this is a threat to this the requirement of confidentiality, which I mentioned, or secrecy. Then, the second thing about this authenticity requirement, which should make sure that you know who you are communicating with. This is on the internet is also a problem because it's rather easy, firstly, to bring down a network node by a so-called denial of service attack. These attacks have been actually quite well known in the media. There was, like, I think 1 or 2 years ago, there was a really high-profile distributed denial of service attack against some well-known websites such as Yahoo, which actually caused a couple of, I don't know, 100 millions of damage because they were not able to run for a couple of hours. And yeah, so these kind of denial of service attacks can actually be launched against by most network nodes. And thereby you can bring down a certain node in the network. And then secondly, by using the so-called spoofing technique, an adversary can then also replace the node which was brought down by this denial of service attack and then masquerade as this network node. So you communicate with another node and you think, or at least you think you do, although there's an adversary who's actually masquerading as this node. And this is, as I said, violates this authenticity requirement. Then another kind of requirement which goes both against the confidentiality, another kind of attacks which violates the confidentiality requirement and also the integrity requirement is the so-called man-in-the-middle attack, where an adversary using a forged connection sits in between the communication between two partners and sometimes simply relays the communication without actually doing anything interesting, but who may also be able to simply drop a message coming from participant A and send to participant B, and instead of this message, send on another message. So this is in this way you can also, in this picture, there's Alice trying to communicate with Bob, but in fact, the adversary Mallory managed to get the connection over his own computer instead of having it across the correct connection, and thereby having this man-in-the-middle attack where the communication may be relayed, but it may also be dropped, and instead some other information may be sent without the participants knowing. So these are some quite well-known established attacks which you can do, for example, on the internet. And now I would like to explain what kind of defenses people came up with in order to deal with the problem, which is, of course, well-known from the initial, from the start of the internet, because that's the way it was designed. And so people from rather early on thought about how they could protect the information that is exchanged over those vulnerable communication links. And this is, of course, done using coding or cryptography. And the general principle is probably also well known to everyone. I mean, going back from school, where everyone tried to encrypt information using more or less secure encryption schemes, such as rotating the letters in an alphabet. This is not really used in this more serious setting, but I mean, that's the general setting where you have some kind of plain text whose confidentiality you want to be protected, and you have some kind of encryption key selected from a set of keys, the so-called key space, and using this this key you produce the ciphertext by some kind of encryption mechanism. This is then communicated to your communication partner, possibly over an unreliable communication link, and the partner is then able to decrypt the information using a corresponding decryption key, which should somehow be linked to the encryption key, and then we'll get back the plain text. And that's the general situation. Of course, before you are able to do this, you somehow need to exchange these keys and to make some kind of appointment, what kind of keys you use and what the keys are supposed to be. And this, of course, again has to go over a secure channel. So in this way, you have some sort of bootstrapping situation here. And on the other hand, you have the attacker who is trying to perform some cryptanalysis here and try to find out the original information, even though it is protected. And of course, the security of this whole situation relies on the fact that the algorithms for encryption and decryption which are used are actually secure. And of course, there has been a lot of research on that this is actually the case. And while this research produced quite a number of different alternatives by now, which you can use as they are, and generally it's really an important advice to try to use established mechanisms and algorithms as far as you know, as somehow possible, because it's, as I said already, it's very difficult to design these mechanisms from scratch. So wherever possible, one should use the mechanisms that were designed earlier by the experts and which have actually been analyzed for maybe 10 or 20 years now. And so firstly, I should say that maybe, as may also be known already, that in this situation there are two kinds of mechanisms which you could use, and they differ in the way that the encryption and the decryption keys are being linked. So firstly, the more classical approach, which is maybe easier to understand in a way, is the so-called symmetric cryptography, where the encryption key and the decryption key are sometimes simply the same. So one example for that would be exclusive OR. So you use some kind of encryption key, and then you which should be long enough to as long as at least a part of the text that you want to encrypt, then you perform an exclusive OR operation with your plain text using the encryption key, and then the other communication partner can do the same kind of operation using the same key, and this way we'll get out the earlier information. Of course, I want to note that exclusive OR is not really a secure encryption operation, but I just mentioned this to have some kind of intuitive example. So this would be an example for a symmetric encryption, but then about 20 or 30 years ago, some people really had some ingenious idea, and this enabled them to design encryption schemes where the encryption and the decryption key are actually different, and where you can actually publish the encryption scheme to everyone, and as long as you keep the decryption key private or a secret, the system is still secure. This is the so-called asymmetric cryptographic schemes, also called public key cryptosystems. And an example for that which is quite well known is the RSA cryptosystem, which was one of the first cryptosystems designed in this way. And so these asymmetric encryption schemes usually rely on some sophisticated mathematics. For example, the security of the RSA algorithm relies on the fact that it is difficult to factorize large integers which consist of few prime factors. And so far, the current state of the art is that RSA is still assumed to be secure, although this hasn't actually been proven yet, but simply because no one has, by now, has been able to actually attack the system in an efficient way. And I should also say a bit about the symmetric algorithms. So there used to be the main standard called the Digital Encryption Standard, DES, which was standardized by the American government for a long time ago, but this has now been replaced by the so-called Advanced Encryption Standard, AES, which was finalized in 2001, which is based on the so-called Rheindahl algorithm developed in Belgium. And so this is the current state of the art, because it turned out that the DES algorithm, with its rather short key length, is not perfectly secure anymore if you assume that you could have military-grade adversaries who actually are able to construct dedicated hardware that can actually crack these algorithms by brute force. And this is why the AES algorithm has been designed now. And there are also some other alternatives to the RSA algorithm, such as the Al-Gamal algorithm, and also algorithms based on that, such as the Diffie-Hellman algorithm. Another one, another kind of algorithm here I want to mention is the electric curves algorithms, which are also often used in the setting of smart cards because they are relatively efficient, and these are also assumed to be secure, although they have not been analyzed as long as the RSA algorithm.
So can you say what of those methods, I mean in terms of symmetric and asymmetric, is why? Can be easier attacked?
So firstly, I should explain why you actually still have both of these kind of algorithms. So both of them have advantages, namely the symmetric algorithms. These are usually much more performant than the asymmetric ones, simply because these asymmetric algorithms have to rely on sophisticated mathematics. And this is why the symmetric ones are still around. Now, but you still use asymmetric algorithms, although they are much slower, maybe 1,000 times as slow as the other ones, because they really are useful in situations, for example, such as the internet, where you're not able to assume from the start that every pair of possible communication partner has a shared encryption key from the start. And so this is the basic principle. You assume that maybe everyone has a public-private key pair, which can be somehow accessed by everyone else. And if two communication partners want to communicate, then they do this by firstly using exchanging a symmetric session key using this asymmetric public-private key pair. So this is why, and in this way, both of these kind of algorithms are still used in a hybrid way. And now the question was, okay, which of them are more secure? Well, in this symmetric case, as I mentioned, the AES is more secure than the DES. And if you compare symmetric and asymmetric, it's not really easy to compare them in terms of security. I mean, the situation is you need both of them for different kinds of applications. Of course, because symmetric algorithms are much more performant, you will usually use them as far as you can. But if you cannot do this because of the reasons I mentioned, you use some kind of asymmetric algorithm, and there, while the safest bet is probably the RSA algorithm, simply because it's the oldest one and it's been most thoroughly examined by the security researchers. But if, as I already mentioned, also if you have a situation where you only have low performance nodes, there you may want to use elliptic graph algorithms because they are faster usually. And okay, just a simple example here about why how these mechanisms work. If you look at them as a sort of black box, from a black box kind of view, then in this situation where A sends a message to B, a message M, which is encrypted under a key K, but at the same time also sends the encryption key K, then of course the secrecy of this value M is not preserved, because if we assume that there's an adversary launching some kind of man-in-the-middle attack, because this may be an internet connection, then the adversary can read the key K and can also decrypt the message M, and therefore the secrecy is not preserved here. But if the key K is somehow exchanged in a different way on a secure channel, then the secrecy of the message M is in fact preserved. And this is sort of the hyper-encryption schemes which I already mentioned when I compared the two kinds of encryption mechanisms just now. And this is there's a picture how this looks like. So firstly, in order to you want to encrypt a plain text using symmetric encryption to get a ciphertext, because this is, as I said, this is much more performant. But in order to be able to distribute the session key to start with, you firstly have to encrypt the session key using asymmetric encryption, and firstly send this session key to the receiver of the message, and the receiver can then decrypt the session key, and they can then use the session key to decrypt the ciphertext, and thereby get the plain text. So this is a sort of two-step approach, which may look a bit complicated, but this is really what you want in order to have a mechanism which is really as performant as possible, but still secure. And there are also a short example about security of this kind of mechanisms, again assuming that there's an adversary sitting in the middle here as a man-in-the-middle attack. Then in this situation, if we assume that the adversary is actually in the in the position to actively insert messages into this network, then this kind of little protocol is actually not secure here, because the adversary is able to delete or to drop the message that is exchanged here, and instead send or create his own encryption of his own session key, K prime, under the public key of B, and send this to B in fact. And then B will simply assume that the session key which was received by over the network actually originated by A, although this was not actually the case, and will simply use the key and encrypt the message M and send it back to A. And in that situation, the adversary can actually decrypt the message, because it was in fact his session key that was inserted in or injected in the communication at that point. So against an active adversary, this kind of communication is not secure. Although against a passive adversary, used only to read the information exchange, it would actually be secure, because firstly, the adversary would not be able to read the session key, because it's encrypted under the public key of B, and then secondly, the adversary would not be able to read the message M, because it's encrypted under the session key, which is not known to the adversary. So this rather trivial example maybe already points out that it's not really easy to design these kind of mechanisms correctly, because the same mechanism is in fact secure against one kind of adversary, namely the passive one, but it's insecure against another kind of adversary, namely the one who can actually actively interfere with the communication. So far I mainly talked about enforcing confidentiality or secrecy. The point now is that the mechanisms like encryption, which you can use to reach secrecy, are not actually, in principle, not good enough to also enforce integrity. So it's having protecting some kind of information from being seen by someone else is a different kind of thing than protecting it from being modified from someone else. So it's easy to come up with some kind of encryption scheme where the information is still secret, but where the adversary can in fact modify the information without being able to actually read it, which may sound a bit paradoxical, but this is actually possible. And therefore, for enforcing this integrity mechanism, we need some kind of second kind of cryptographic mechanism, and this is the so-called digital signature. This is also some kind of coding algorithm where you start with a plain text, and here you firstly apply some kind of hash function, which reduces the size of this text, as you know from the hash functions which you use in a non-security critical setting. And the point here is also performance reasons, because in the second step, you then, for example, you can apply this asymmetric decryption from the RSA algorithm, and then you get the digital signature. The point is, at least with this RSA algorithm, you can use the two kind of mechanisms, the encryption and the decryption, in both ways. So you can firstly encrypt something and then decrypt it and get back the plain text, but you can also firstly decrypt some bit string and then do the encryption as a second step, and then you will also get back the original plain, the original bit string. This is a property which is at least possible with the RSA algorithm, and this is exploited in this kind of digital signature algorithms. And the advantage here is also that whereas with asymmetric encryption, the idea is that everyone can encrypt the message because the public key is known to everyone, but only the owner of the private key is able to decrypt the information, whereas in the case of the digital signature, it's just the other way around. Only the owner of the private key is able to sign the document, but everyone is then later able to verify using the public key that this is actually the signature of the particular document. And this is, in this way, the signature can sort of work the other way around than the encryption. But here one also has to make sure that one uses the correct secure algorithms. For example, although this is actually some kind of hash function, it's not secure to use just some ordinary hash function which you would use elsewhere, but it has to be actually a secure hash function, because you have certain security critical requirements here which you usually don't have if you just use hash functions for some ordinary goal. And the requirements are, for example, that it should not be possible for an adversary to create two plain texts which will result into the same signature in the end. Because then somehow the adversary could trick you into signing one of these two plain texts because it looks innocent for some reason, and then use the other plain text which may be less innocent against you. So one of them may claim that you want to buy something for €1, and the other one may say that you want to buy it for €1,000, and it should not be possible that you sign the first contract and then the adversary be able later to claim that you say, in fact signed the second contract. And the problem actually exists to start with because of this situation that you use the hash function to reduce the amount of text which you actually want to sign here because of performance reasons. Whenever you use you reduce the amount of text, this means that you will have some kind of you have the situation in principle that two different plain text will be mapped to the same hash simply because you reduce the set of possible texts, and this has to be encountered again by using a secure algorithm at that point also. This is sort of the verification mechanism which I already mentioned. So firstly, you sign the message using the hash function and the digital encryption function, and then in the second step, you verify the signature by creating firstly also the hash of the plain text, and then by comparing the hash with the encryption of the signature using the public key. So much about the underlying cryptographic algorithms. Next, I would like to talk about some mechanisms which are based on a more the next higher level in the system. And two very simple examples of these cryptographic protocols I have already shown as examples. So in general, cryptographic protocols are, you could say, are very small programs which realize some kind of interaction between different parts of the system. For example, different nodes that are distributed over the system and which have the goal to set up some kind of secure relation between the two or more communication partners. So for example, you may want to set up a secure communication channel, or you may want to distribute keys or perform electronic transactions and so on. And for all of these, you use these kind of cryptographic protocols. The situation here is also that it's really difficult to design them correctly. And this one example I mentioned already of this Lisa and Schroeder protocol, which was attacked 17 years later by someone else. This is also another thing where you want to use established mechanisms as far as possible, but in this case here, this is sometimes not actually possible. So if you use a certain hardware node, which is simply not performant enough to use the classical protocols, or if you have a certain security requirement which is not covered by the existing protocols, then sometimes you do have to design your own protocols. But the advice is to be very careful when doing that, because as I mentioned already, even experts have gone wrong here. And the general situation here is that actually this should be emulated. just to demonstrate what the situation is here and in which way such a protocol could in principle be attacked by an adversary who is sitting in the middle. I just want to demonstrate what can happen if there's a man-in-the-middle attack. And yeah, this is the scenario where a participant A wants to communicate with the protocol participant B, and for example across the internet connection, and there is a man-in-the-middle attack. And again, we have to assume that all communication is done through the adversary. And we may assume that the adversary has some initial knowledge which maybe some public keys which are known to everyone, or maybe he has his own private key, and so on. And then the protocol starts by A sending a message to what was the intended recipient B, but in fact it is being caught by the adversary in the middle, and then the adversary also gets this information in his knowledge, because he can simply read the message if it's not encrypted. Then the adversary may choose to forward the information or the message to the intended recipient, who then chooses to return some other kind of message back to A. But again, the adversary in the middle gets hold of this message, and it's added to his knowledge. And then, in fact, the adversary is able to use his decryption key to decrypt the information which is sent using this encryption mechanism, assuming that he is actually in the possession of this encryption decryption key. And then the adversary may actually choose to forward some other kind of message to A. So this is the general situation in which an adversary could try to attack a protocol. To show how this kind of protocol could be used in the system context, this is an example. You're not supposed to be able to read the details here, but the idea is simply that you have the situation where you have two nodes in a system, and these are supposed to be connected by an encrypted communication link, and you want to implement this using some kind of standardized security protocol. And this you could do by using some kind of standardized protocol, which then is supposed to encrypt the information and to exchange the session keys, and then you can actually use an internet connection in order to transfer this the messages that are exchanged within the protocol. So this is the sort of design process which you might want to use. Firstly, think about which kind of connections in the system should be protected, and then in the next step, insert the cryptographic protocols that are needed to exchange the session keys, and so on. And in general, these encryption mechanisms may apply on the different layers which you have in a communication system, starting down from the network level up to the application level. You have different kinds of algorithms and security protocols which you can use to set up a secure communication link on all of these levels. So I don't have the time to actually explain all of these algorithms and protocols, but I will just give some examples in the following. And in particular, since you were mentioned that there would be particular interest in mobile IP, I will start with telling a bit about the security of the mobile IP protocols. So firstly, maybe I should ask, was there supposed to be a break in the middle, or yes. What time right now maybe?
It depends on if this...
Yeah, this would be a good point, I think, too. So how long?
10 minutes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So we're going to start 10 minutes after 5.
Okay. Are there any questions at this point about the first part of the presentation? Otherwise, we'll just continue in 10 minutes.